Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, a conversation about architecture. We'll learn how buildings can be designed to enhance our personal lives and the life of our community as well. How buildings well designed can bring out the best in the people who work and study or live in them. And what's called our built environment here in Columbus, that can help us feel more pleased about our city. My guest, Jack Nasser, is professor of city and regional planning here at The Ohio State University. His new book is called Designing for Designers, Lessons Learned from Schools of Architecture. Welcome back, Jack Nasser. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Glad to be here again.
And we're at 614-292-8513. Talking about that built environment, I was recently visiting an industrial city in a developing country where they'd thrown up, and I mean thrown up, although I'm sure they're very sturdily built, a lot of huge buildings that were done, you know, practically speaking, they had to get them up quick. There was a burgeoning population, but they didn't look like much. They weren't pleasing to the eye, and it gave you a feeling of a soulless skyline. Is that possible?
Yes, I believe it is. I think we could measure the way people react to their surroundings, and I think that there's a degree to which different kinds of buildings and groups of buildings would convey different meanings to folks. Mm-hmm. So possibly your first reaction to that it felt soulless, barren, mm-hmm. Would be one that would be shared by lots of other people, in which case we would say, yeah, it did convey that meaning to the general public experiencing it.
And the difficulty is that we were talking earlier before the show about public feedback. The difficulty is that when you get feedback to architecture, if it's negative feedback, generally it's too late. The building's there. They're not going to tear it down.
Well, there's actually a different way of looking at that. So the degree to which the building is there, there is feedback that can be used to retrofit the building to improve it. Actually, one of the case studies in our book on the University of Sydney, it was the new dean came to the School of Architecture and read in the local newspaper, the Sydney Morning Herald, that it was considered the ugliest building in Australia or all of Sydney.
And it's a School of Architecture.
It's a School of Architecture. So he was not pleased with that. And he felt that they needed to do something about it to improve it. So they actually did what we have a number of in the book, a post-occupancy evaluation, systematically looking at the users and passersby and getting their reactions to what worked and what didn't work, mm-hmm. and use the results of that to then go to donors and say, you know, we have this building that's considered the ugliest building in the country. Here are some things we could do to improve it. And he was able to get some money to then come back and retrofit the building to make it a more livable place. I was there before the retrofit and mm-hmm. afterwards, and it's not a perfect building, but to me it's a lot better. So it's there and you could learn from it. But beyond that, you could learn for the next building that you build.
Sure.
So that building is there, and whether it's the next School of Architecture or some other building, there is some feed forward of information that you can get from that so that the next building can benefit from the lessons learned from the former one.
Jack, it's interesting. In your new book, Designing for Designers, Lessons Learned from Schools of Architecture, you look at schools of architecture, their design. You know, you think a school of architecture at a university would be a marvelous building, but that's not always the case, right?
Yeah, I guess it depends on who's looking at it. I suspect that a number of architects would think that the buildings are wonderful. But when you actually look at the students and faculty and staff and passersby, there's a degree to which not all these buildings do that well. So some do marvelously and some not so marvelously. And there is the reason we use the lessons learned is that we evaluated buildings over a 25-year period from all across the United States and internationally, three buildings from Sweden, Turkey, and as I talked about, Australia. And we found that over a 25-year period, were there any lessons learned? So if you went back to the first of these new contemporary buildings built in 1976 to the more recent ones built in the 2006-2005, did the newer ones gain any information from the older ones?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was no.
No.
No lessons learned. The spaces that really worked well and were really liked in the old ones were there in the new ones. So in a sense, that lesson was passed forward. The things that didn't work well, which were eminently correctable, very easily correctable sorts of things without sacrificing, I don't think, were just not handled in the newer buildings, and they were not handled in the older buildings. Mm-hmm. So the degree to which there was a feed forward of information was non-existent.
So, Jack, you seemed to say earlier that let's say for a school of architecture, a building which houses an architecture school on a university campus, that students and faculty may respond negatively over time to that building and consistently respond negatively, thinking it's ugly or uninspiring or soulless. But you said, but the architects may view that differently. Is there a split between educated architect opinion and public opinion, or what?
There is a value difference between some architects and some members of the public. So there is this difference in norms in terms of what they want to see in good building. There's a degree to which some architects, and certainly critics and design award juries, oftentimes look at the building as a work of art. So they could look at it as if it were a picture that was hung up in a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're judging it on those criteria in terms of artistic aesthetic criteria, some of the other things may be not that important.
And other things
whether it's hard to find the front door and whether it's acoustically got problems and whether to the general public who may not know these different levels of aesthetic theories that are underlining it, and so they just look at the building as they would on a day-to-day experience, their reactions may not matter as much. So there is, to some extent, that kind of disconnect between these two sets of values that, mm-hmm. that happen. Let me give you an example.
Yeah.
A friend of mine walked through the building, our building, the Knowlton School of Architecture.
Here at the OSU.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And shortly after it was opened, and he was with an architect, and he was talking about, they walked through, and they both agreed that this thing didn't work. It was hard to find your way around. The acoustics were a problem. The stairway was ugly. There was consensus on these facts of it. And so they finished this talk, and the architect said, "But I really like the building." And my friend said, "I really don't like the building." Same set of basic facts about they agreed on these things that didn't work, but one person said, "Well, those things," essentially was saying, "those things aren't as important as what I think of as the aesthetic statement."
Yeah.
And the other person was saying, "Yeah, the aesthetic statement is important, but it's part of a range of other things." So, yeah, there is this disconnect.
So you got it with a building. You got an aesthetic statement, how it appears, whether it's pleasing to the eye, right? But then you have these other things. Can you find the front door? Can you find your way around the building? Is the heating and air conditioning sufficient?
Right.
Is there some natural light indoors? Do spaces feel cramped? I mean, all those practical. Well, they're practical considerations, but they're human considerations, right?
And there are a top 10 problems in many new buildings. So the things that are sort of common sort of things that occur in many new buildings. So I'll give you some of the top 10. I don't remember all of them,
mm-hmm.
but architects are supposed to be professional. So we hire architects, I think, as we do other professionals, because they're supposed to bring a special expertise or knowledge for the health, welfare, and safety of people.
Sure.
So the problems are leakage, heating, ventilation, air conditioning.
Now, by leakage, you mean rain and you mean water.
Water, snow, whatever, leaking through the roof. Now, I'm not blaming architects for this. These are things they may subcontract out to other people to do. They've subcontracted out a lot of things. Heating, ventilation, air conditioning. Signage and wayfinding is also sort of, people not being able to find a door, not being able to find the main place in the building. Accessibility, the ease of getting around a building. The aesthetics, and I want to come back and touch on that because you raised this idea of pleasingness to the eye. Acoustics and lighting. Storage, and the related thing to storage is objects that are stuck out in hallways because there isn't storage, so it blocks movement through the thing. So these are some common problems. Some of them maybe within the architect's domain, maybe some are within the whoever they subcontracted out that didn't do an adequate job on HVAC or some negotiation between them. The aesthetics thing raises an interesting thing because pleasing to the eye raises the question of to whose eye.
Yeah.
So is it the, if you look at the convention center downtown in Columbus, is it the people who come to the convention center, the thousands of people in Columbus who pass by it, or is it some architects and architect theorists who recognize certain aspects of that design that maybe the layperson on their day-to-day walk through the city might not recognize? And so that you get, again, this is the rationale for the disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
Pleasing to the eye of the educated architect or pleasing to the eye of the person on the street? And do they have to be different? Is there a possibility of, in fact, creating buildings and places that both groups look at and say, this is a good building, this is a good place?
Well, what do you think of the, I mean, from the viewpoint, Jack, your own viewpoint, how would you evaluate the convention center as you pass it and you look at it?
I would, I'd rather not give my, you know, with when our book came out, there was a review of the design, Designing for Designers in the Chronicle of Higher Education. Mm-hmm. And immediately after that, an architecture blog had lit up with statements by architecture students and, I guess, faculty reminiscing or thinking about the buildings that they were educated in. And so you'd have one person saying, I really like such and such a building. And then another person might say, I saw a picture of that building and I didn't like it. And then another person wrote, I like this building. I didn't like it. It was all I. And so how I react to the convention center as an individual, to me, is irrelevant. What's more relevant is how those thousands of people who experience it react. And so if you ask me, I suspect that they don't react very favorably to
really?
It in Columbus. I don't know, but you know, maybe the callers will give us some ideas of what they think about it.
By the way, which is 614-292-8513, we're talking about architecture, how a well-designed building can be aesthetically pleasing, make you feel good when you walk by it and into it, and also some of the practical human situations within making the building inviting to people who work or study or who live in the building. Jack Nasser is professor of city and regional planning here at The Ohio State University. And my guest's new book, Designing for Designers, Lessons Learned from Schools of Architecture. We're at 614-292-8513. What do you think of the, what is your thought about the convention center as you pass it, as you enter it, and maybe some of the other buildings you'd like to talk about here in Columbus as well? Of course, Jack, I suppose there's no way of knowing, I mean, but without a public survey, what the public thinks of the 40 or the convention center or any other building here in the capital city, right?
Yeah, and that's actually part of what the post-occupancy evaluations did of these 16, 17 schools of architecture. So for Knowlton Hall, for example, we interviewed passersby. We have something like 79 passersby, and we asked them a series of questions about the way they reacted to the exterior. Those of you who know the campus, there's a building a block or two away called the Physics Research Building. I think that's the name of it. And we also interviewed passersby with the same questions about that. So we actually have survey data in terms of the range of passersby. It was like 36 mm-hmm. different disciplines, faculty, students, staff. So I would ask your viewers, your listeners, to also sort of, if they're familiar with Knowlton Hall or the Physics Research Building, maybe they could give us their reactions to that as well.
What did your surveys find in terms of reactions to the Knowlton School of Architecture, for example?
Well, there was the standard split that I just talked about. Mm. The passersby did not react very favorably to it. In fact, if you compare on all the scales that we measured it on compared to the same scales that we measured the physics building on, physics building scored better. It was judged as more exciting, more impressive. People liked it more. They'd be more willing to walk out of their way to see it. They judged it. We had a reverse scale item, which is that this is the ugliest building on campus, and they judged the one, you know, they, in terms of these different items, physics buildings scored much better than Knowlton Hall. And in fact, we've done this with 15 different buildings on campus, and I'm sorry to say that if you just took that data, Knowlton Hall is the ugliest building on campus.
The architecture
to the passersby. I should add the other side to that. When we interviewed people in the building, it got somewhat favorable scores in terms of the way they reacted to the exterior. And when you
people look, who work in the building.
Yeah.
When you study in the building.
Right, rather than just the passersby. And when you actually look more closely at the data, you find that that's driven to a good extent by more favorable scores given by architects to the exterior than by the landscape architects and the city and regional planning faculty and by, you know, students and staff. So there's, again, that dichotomy there, and that comes down to a value question, I guess, in terms of which one, or is there some way to mix the two?
Well, we have a number of callers on the line who'd like to express their opinions about, we would think of maybe a variety of buildings. Let's go to you, callers. John is our first caller. Hi, John.
Hi. How you guys doing today?
Good.
Good. My question had to do with architects being a service profession, and why I'm just to qualify myself, I'm a builder. And one of the things I constantly run into in having to deal with the architect and the client is the architect refusing, well, not refusing outright, but not adapting to the wishes of the client. I find a lot of times where architects will go in and put their own spin on it, which I understand, but that's not what the client was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Great example that I have is we're doing work on a Civil War-style military house. And if you go to Fort Myers, this house looks like it came straight out of there from D.C. And the folks wanted a big addition on the back. Architect did a great job with the interior as far as setting up the HVAC and the stoppage of air leakage and water leakage into the home. But looking at the back of it, all of a sudden, you're like, well, hold it, wait a minute. This doesn't look at all like Civil War era military construction.
So, question.
Sitting in the guy's office, I suddenly realized, oh, he just reconfigured the building that he won an award on 5 years ago. He just superimposed that design.
Yeah. Well, let's get Jen Holland, Jack Nasser, the architect as a service profession as opposed to doing what the heck they want to do.
Well, John, it's a great question, and it's one that I'm right in line with you on. I believe that, first of all, I think there's been a sort of paradigm shift in the country and the world from sort of top-down autocratic solutions to bottom-up, consumer-oriented, learning from the past, continuous improvement kinds of things. So, you know, when I think of professions, if I go to a doctor, and I go to a doctor not because I want the doctor to make a statement about medicine. I go to the doctor because I want them to be able to diagnose a problem and help cure it. And recent books on medicine has actually shown that the things that some doctors miss out on, and I'm going to come back to architecture eventually on this, is that they don't listen that well. So the best diagnosticians are the ones who sit down with the patient and look at the patient, ask questions, and listen. And similarly, if I go to a lawyer, another profession, I don't go to a lawyer to make a statement. I want the lawyer to resolve my problem. And I agree with you. I believe that architects, if they're a profession, if they want to be licensed by a profession, we don't license artists.
Right.
And if we license the architects a profession, we expect them to provide a consumer service. So, and there are a number of architects who do. I think a lot of probably local practitioners are more consumer-oriented or interested in resolving or solving problems with a client. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they have to give up some of their professional knowledge or expertise about craft, use of materials, and things like that. So, it's a shame. It's a shame that some do that, I guess, in terms of my value system. I wish, and I teach, I guess, the idea of working with people and listening, and so I'm with you on it. And I'm not quite sure what if you're asking for the solution, I'm not quite sure what it is, other than sort of doing what you're doing, is sort of working with them and letting them know what you expect.
John, thanks for your call. Our next caller here is Vicki. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I just came to Columbus a few years ago and have lived in lots of other cities with humongous convention centers. And I have to tell you, when I saw the one here, I loved it. And I'll tell you why, because usually they're monolithic and ugly and just they can take up blocks and blocks and blocks of a city's landscape. And the one here is humongous. It does take up blocks and blocks, but it's visually broken up into different shapes, different sizes, different colors. And I just thought it was great. Now, it's only really good on High Street. From the back, it's pretty awful. But at least it breaks it up. It's a human scale, and the doorways are different, and the windows are different, and I really like it. I've heard other people say they hate it, but I like it.
So it doesn't look like this big, massive wall that you might
No,
see.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. It looks more like a bunch of adjacent buildings that are designed cohesively.
And you find that very pleasing.
I do.
Mm-hmm. Well, Vicki, thanks for your opinion. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
And... George, hang on, Jack.
Yeah, Vicki, I think you make a great point that the degree to which the buildings around it are subdivided into smaller sets, and then you have this other massive building where the design tries to break it up. So that is a good fit. To me, it's unfortunate. Again, this is just personal opinion, that the building doesn't do more to enliven the street So where you have the building has little sort of almost courtyards facing the street, you don't have really places where people could sit and gather, which would and you don't have places where you could look into the building or you could look out of the building onto the street. So it doesn't, on the one hand, I agree with your points in terms of this. There's a pretty solid body of research showing, you know, if you created public gathering places like what you maybe see in the Short North where the people there, people like to watch people. That would also maybe add to it and enliven it. Mm-hmm. But thanks for your point.
Thanks. George is next. Hello, George.
Hi. I think the timing here is perfect because I fall just exactly on the opposite side of the fence from the previous caller. I hate that building. I think that it's. I will grant that it's it is broken up, so it doesn't seem to be monolithic. But it's broken up in sort of a disorganized, silly fashion. And I think that the color scheme, which would probably work in Miami, does not work at all in Columbus, Ohio. I think it's sort of a an anomaly there on High Street. And I've got to stay from my standpoint as a musician. I've worked many times inside that main convention space inside that place, and I think that it does an abysmal job of doing what it's supposed to do. I once stood on a stage in that space in there and clapped my hands one time and heard 17 iterations of that clap.
Oh,
now, you can imagine what that does when anybody's trying to do any sort of a presentation in there that involves music or the spoken word or anything. So I think that the building just fails miserably in its purpose.
George, the color scheme, remind us of some of the colors on the exterior.
We got sort of like pastels. The whole thing is like a pastel green, pinkish sort of. It's got this weird sort of South Florida feel that just is a total mismatch, I think, for Columbus, Ohio. I've scratched my head ever since that building has been built, and wondering who authorized that and who thought that was a good idea. So I guess it'll just have to remain one of the mysteries of time.
Jack, that is a very interesting color scheme. Pastels, you know, uh-huh. in a place where you wouldn't think that there'd be pastels.
Maybe some fake palm trees would help.
you're talking about the sort of the, what you see it better, I think, when you go around the back of the building, the sort of the roof colors.
Yeah.
Again, personal opinion, I think it's out of that those colors are out of context for the local vernacular that you'd have here.
They're totally. It seems like it was just sort of imposed on the neighborhood without any kind of consideration for the surrounding buildings or the surrounding feel of the neighborhood there. So I would agree with you, gentlemen. Thanks for the great program.
Well, these two calls are great. Vicky saying she really likes it, and George saying he hates it. So if we looked around and spoke to a bunch of people, and there was complete disagreement. You know, there was no one could agree whether they liked it or disliked it, and there was, you know, some people were indifferent. I guess you could say, in a sense, it doesn't matter. But if we actually, as we did with our surveys on the various campuses, we found a convergence of opinion. And we're not going to get that through phone calls in. But if we found a convergence of opinion where, say, most people loved it, mm-hmm. then we might say that, at least in terms of the public eye, it was a success. Or if most people, which is what I've heard more people responding like George did, that they don't like it. That we used to, I mean, when it was first built, people were referring to it as the train wreck on High Street.
Yeah.
then, in fact, we would say that it's not, at least in terms of the public reaction to it, it's not a success.
Yeah, but we don't have any survey, do we?
I don't have any data.
No data.
Then people calling in and commenting and hearing reactions to it.
Jack Nasser is professor of city and regional planning here at Ohio State University, and we're going to be back talking about our architecture, our built environment, how well-designed buildings can be aesthetically pleasing and also very practical for human occupation. After these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Alex Chadwick.
My name is Majay Booker.
People really are fascinating, aren't they?
How can a 9-year-old without a ticket get onto 2 flights?
But what is it that makes them do the things that they do?
They said, no, you can't get off. They told me how to sit down.
Who, what, where, when, yes, but also why?
I just wanted to see my grandpa.
On NPR's Day to Day.
And Day to Day will be here at noon, only about 30 minutes away. Day to Day. And on today's edition of Day to Day, they're a growing religious and political force in the country. But don't call them the religious right. attracting the Hispanic evangelical vote. That's coming up later today during Day to Day. And good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich here with you. Thanks for joining us for Open Line. And join us for live coverage of the governor's State of the State address from the State House News Bureau. Hear the speech and reaction from lawmakers on Governor Strickland's plans for Ohio. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on WOSU 820. And you can listen to Open Line with Fred Anderle where you want and when you want with the Open Line podcast. Search Open Line at the iTunes Music Store to download each program to your iPod or MP3 device. And in the forecast for today, rain showers off and on throughout the day, a chance of a thunderstorm, a high of around 62 today. For tonight, periods of showers and a chance of a thunderstorm, a low of 48. And now back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. We're talking about architecture, about how buildings can be designed to enhance our personal lives and the life of our community. Back with us here, Jack Nasser, professor of city and regional planning here at The Ohio State University. His new book, Designing for Designers, Lessons Learned from Schools of Architecture. We're at 614-292-8513. Wonder if you got a favorite building or a building you particularly despise here in Columbus. what do you think of the Levesque Tower? Is that a building you find architecturally pleasing? And maybe you'd like to nominate it at a list for the number of top 10 best, 10 worst pieces of public architecture here in terms of building. 614-292-8513. Dee is on the line. Hi, Dee.
Yes. I have two things. I want to ask about loading docks, but first I have to weigh in very quickly on the convention center. I have found universally people who were here for at least 5 years before it was built hate it. We call it the fun house. And people who are from out of town love it and think it's Art Nouveau. It's wonderful.
Okay.
I found that very consistently. But if you were here, I'm from Akron originally, but I'd been here long enough that I thought it was, well, like I say, my friends and I all refer to it as the fun house.
Interesting split there, Jack, that people would come from another town think it's great, and I don't know if we can.
I found that universally, every party that's ever discussed it, and it gets discussed at parties a lot.
Okay.
So that's great. I mean, for the visitors, the convention center should be something that the visitors look at and say, this is a great place. It's unfortunate that the local residents.
But for those of us who have to drive down High Street every day to go to work,
right. It's
still fugly.
Right. So it's unfortunate that you can't have something that both does what it does for the visitors and then has the, as you said, the people who drive by it every day look at it and say, yeah, I love it also.
Right. But my real question was about loading docks. I have a friend who used to deliver freight downtown, and she had not one but about a dozen horror stories about places whose loading docks are so poorly set up that you had to back a van in with literally 2 or 3 inches clearance on either side.
Oh, yeah.
And I've seen this myself both downtown and at a building on Long Street. I've watched semis that cannot make a 3-point turn without having to come within a foot or less of 3 different stationary points every time they load up back up to this loading dock. And I just wondered, you know, is this something that architects leave till last when they're on deadline crunch, or just what's happening there?
Jack, what do you think?
Well, I'm not a practicing architect, so I can't answer your question, but when you program a building to talk about, you know, what goes into it, there are obviously trade-offs, and you make decisions about what's most important and what's less important. And so it might be that, you know, either in the programming phase or in the design phase, there is a trade-off made, and even though deliveries are an important component of the functioning of the building, someone decides that that is less important than whatever else is. And so that ends up being given less importance. I don't know. It's unfortunate that, again, you know, in architecture you're trying to fit all these constraints and concerns into a building that's got a limited site. And it's what you describe is an unfortunate thing. You'd like it to work better.
But an architect should be aware of that. A good architect should be thinking about trucks and their ability to approach a loading dock, right?
I would think so, particularly in a building where you have regular loading and it's a part of the main function of the building. And then there is, you know, how do you, or whoever they might subcontract out to someone who talks about that loading. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why it seems like you're saying it's a common problem. I know that in at least 2 of the buildings we evaluated on campus, it was a major problem as well. So
I think it's a widespread thing, and I think it goes back to top-down design, which is hopefully changing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dee.
Sure.
You know, it must be very difficult for an architect or for the people who, let's say, a new building is commissioned, a new such and such, a new convention center is one example. And those who are responsible pick an architect, and the architect comes up with a series of drawings, right, and illustrations. And, you know, it's got to be awfully difficult in people's minds to project from a drawing or an illustration into what that building actually is going to look like when you put it down in reality.
I think that's changed because we now have such wonderful computer simulation things that, that I think clients are more and more expecting and paying for 3D animation walkthroughs. And so that, you know, it is clearly most people cannot, you know, unless you're trained, can't read a plan.
Surely.
And know what, you know, how am I going to be able to walk through that, what it's going to look like, or even look at an elevation or a section through a building. But they certainly can look at a 3D, either a 3D drawing, rendering, or the more 3D fly-through or walk-through simulations.
Well, you could have a three-dimensional model, too, an actual model.
But
even so, you know, I wonder if somebody looks at a model and a walk-through on the computer and then the building is built and they say, oh, my, that wasn't what I anticipated at all.
Well, we've actually tested some of the anime. We've done some tests with aspects of 3D simulation. So we did some tests of, we're trying to figure out what would help people find their way around better in design. So we had some manipulations that we did, and we looked at these things in 3D virtual reality. So we created basically a neighborhood that manipulated certain features, and we had people navigate it for a while, and then we had them try to find their way to certain destinations. But we were able to compare those results to real on-site experience of, in fact, similar or the same environment. So there's a degree to which we found there is actually a good in other people as well, that the virtual reality simulations, you know, if you got real, looks like real buildings and sidewalks and places.
Very helpful. Yeah.
It's pretty much like the way people react on the real site.
But
there's a degree to which also, you know, I've been in, you know, Knowlton Hall for a few years there, and every day walking through it and experiencing it regularly. So there is an issue of, you know, there may be unexpected things that you're describing, you know, that they may miss when they just look at it for a few minutes and simulate it.
Okay, back to our callers with Robert. Hello, Robert.
Yes.
You're on the air.
I have a question for the professor.
Mm-hmm.
When I was growing up, I remember my grandpa used to always tell me that the most likely place in a house to have water damage would be down in the basement. And my question is, I was wondering what the architects were thinking when they designed Wexner and they put a fine arts library and a cartoon library in the basement of Wexner. Did they anticipate that it was going to leak like a sieve, just like the fancy modern building that they have at MIT that was designed by some hotshot architect?
Robert, I wrote a book about the Wexner Center, called Design by Competition, which actually, among other things, goes through interviewing the users and doing the same kinds of post-occupancy evaluations that we did for the School of Architecture, finds out that, in fact, what you're describing is more pronounced across the whole building. Virtually no space worked the way it was intended to work for the users who occupy it. The particular architect who designed that building has a theory that function doesn't matter.
Yeah, I know.
It's a theory. The function does not matter.
Basically, is making a statement about that it's people are too complacent about the world and other things that have happened in the last century, and so that by making architecture that somehow challenges your ways of, and this, I may not be stating his theory accurately, but this is my rendition of it. You're somehow going to make people aware of these problems. And of course, really what happens is they're more aware that I can't find my way from here to there, or there's a leak in the basement, or the whatever they are. So,
well, they're certainly challenging the staff of the Fine Arts Library and the Cartoon Library. And the same thing's happening at MIT, at that fancy architectural building that they put there. It leaks like a sieve, too. So my suggestion would be maybe architectural students should focus more on pre-architecture studies rather than post-architecture studies.
Okay. Thanks for your call.
Very good, yes.
Robert. Lauren is next. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Fred. I love your show.
Thanks.
I'm a first-time caller, so I'm a little nervous, but thank you to your guests for giving me the opportunity to finally say what I feel about the convention center. I've lived here my whole life, and when it first was going up, everyone was so excited. And I remember the very first time I drove past it, and I thought, it wasn't done yet. It looked like it was maybe primer colors were on there, that the orangey, pinkish, peachy color was maybe a primer coat. Mm-hmm. And I kept hoping that it would become something else. I just couldn't understand why there would be all these pastel colors on a building in downtown Columbus, close to the Short North, where there's so much history.
Sure.
Doesn't seem to fit.
Well, I guess, Jack, that's it.
It's interesting. If you ask the architect, I'm not saying I agree with his intent, yeah, but he actually wanted the building to look like it wasn't done yet. So
he succeeded.
Yeah, he succeeded in terms of that. Then the question is, how do you and other people react to the fact that it doesn't look done yet?
Why did he want the building to look like it wasn't done?
Again, it has to do with some kind of statement about architecture and broader things anyone looking at the building, unless you knew the theory behind it, you wouldn't.
So this is some esoteric elitist theory. Could you characterize it that way?
I won't say elitist, but it is esoteric. Lauren has a wonderful point though that I want to pick up on, that there is a number of people who, if I ask them, and probably some people are listening, what do you think about the convention center? They're afraid to answer. And if they're non-architects, they will say, well, you know, the architect knows better. I really don't like it, but maybe the architect knows something that I don't know. And I'm all with you, Lauren, that you know, if you experience the building on a regular basis, and you look at it and you don't like it, you know something. It's your daily experience, and it's a valued experience. And if a lot of people share your experience, maybe the architect doesn't know something.
That's so true. And I wondered, you know, up a little farther north on the High Street, they've done some wonderful things near campus now. All those glass buildings, and I don't know who designed them, but it makes a great shopping city.
Are you talking about
area?
The Gateway area?
Yes.
Well, now I think we could have a number of opinions about the Gateway area as well.
I just had my students doing some evaluations of the Gateway area. So there are some there's some problems. I mean, again, there's, like any design, there's some good and bad, but there are some problems with the Gateway as well.
Hey, Lauren, thanks so much for your call. Appreciate
it. You're so welcome. Yeah. Bye.
Right, bye. And hello, Sarah. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I, too, am a first-time caller. And just to weigh in on the convention center issue, I am a transplant to Columbus, and I hate it. I hated it even more once I saw the train station that that it replaced, which was so gorgeous. I mean, old pictures, I don't know, maybe it was in disrepair. But I wanted to actually just comment on a residential architectural trend that just bothers me, and that is all these large homes with huge garages as the most prominent feature, straight from the curb. And on top of it all, people are driving more, and so now you have three garage doors on your home. And to me, it just looks like a car lives there.
Well, it does. It's actually a big car.
But I mean, it takes away from the fact that this is a family, or this is a home, or this is a neighborhood of people. It looks like a neighborhood of SUVs. And I have to tell you, I live in Clintonville, which gives you a little indication of sort of my preferences for buildings. But there had been an empty lot for a long time on our street that was just recently replaced with what other people in the neighborhood are calling the Hilliard House. And they say that not in a very flattering way. Because
it's huge, right?
I'm sorry?
It's huge?
Well, it's large, but it also has, again, this prominent garage. The rest of us have detached, you know, in the back, or very small ones attached. But it stands out like a sore thumb because you have this huge garage, you know, dwarfing the house, the large house still behind it. So just mention, I don't know why that's become such a thing.
Well, Jack, what about that?
Are you commenting just about the garage or the overall scale of the house as well?
Well, actually, I think both. I mean, I think, okay. but I think the fact that the garage weighs in so prominently is to me the bigger.
Yeah.
I think it just says a lot about our society. I think architecture really comments a lot on society.
You know, Jack, we haven't talked much about, you know, the architecture of individual homes. Right. And certainly in suburban areas, you do see that very prominent, you know, enormous 2.5-car garage. And yet, frankly, I think most of them are pretty ugly homes that are designed that way. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, yeah, we actually, we've done research on this particular topic. So we have a study that was picked up a few weeks ago in the Columbus Dispatch on McMansions. And they actually, I think they hired a helicopter to fly over that 10,000-square-foot McMansion towards the north west side of Clintonville. I forget the exact street. So we were looking at the degree to which communities across the country have these oversized houses.
Uh-huh.
I think which Sarah would agree with, they're oversized.
Yeah.
And are they doing anything to deal with them? And so we found, to our surprise, that both oversized houses and plats of oversized houses, we build 10 of them or 20 of them. And so they're happening all across the country. Columbus is not unique in this. And about half the communities are putting in place some kinds of controls to deal with it, and others aren't. Upper Arlington right now is having a big debate over McMansions, the teardown of a historic building that was replaced with a McMansion. And so they're trying to figure out how to control that as well. So it's it's something that I think each community has to deal with. Mm-hmm. And design review, I think, is probably a way to handle it, where you bring in, as Seattle, we had a speaker in from Seattle who talked about their design review program mixes an architect, a developer, and a local resident without the so-called design expertise. And they review the house. So if you wanted to put in a larger house, they would review it for its compatibility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that might be a way to handle that.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks for your call. The other issue is I would think that I've seen individual homeowners who contract with, I don't know whether they're architects or just builders, to put an addition on the house, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And the addition to the house destroys the concept, the architectural concept. Maybe it's a historic house, let's say a house built in the 20s. And I've seen some wonderful jobs done in that regard, you know, putting additional rooms on a house that was built in the 20s, let's say. And it really is integral with the house. And You think, my goodness, that's a lovely piece of work. And then others that look tacked on and destroy the whole and destroy. I mean, you don't like to walk by it.
Right.
Thank heavens that most of these are in the back of the house and not in the front. So individual homeowners can go very wrong, too.
Yeah. So then you could there was one case, I think, in Columbus where there was some kind of control where they didn't want people to tear down and replace a building. And one homeowner figured out that he could do it sequentially. So he did one addition, then another addition, then another addition, and finally he replaced the whole building.
Oh,
but, yeah, you're absolutely right. The additions, you know, and people do want more space. Their families mm-hmm. grow or they want more space for the investment value, and so they will add on to an often historic building. So the question is, can you do that in a way that it both works for you as the resident and but is also civil to to your neighbors? You know, you're not putting in an airport landing strip in your suburban yard.
And some neighborhoods have actual restrictions, code restrictions, right, in terms of aesthetics.
Right.
And, of course, others do not. Yeah, probably most do not. Huh?
No, a lot of neighborhoods will have design review as a way of getting at that. So they might have some recommendations and then a commission that sort of looks at it to make sure that what you're putting. But I'm not sure the how closely or how closely those design review commissions are working in terms of. You know, you look at some of the stuff that, in fact, this caller was talking about that's gone up in Clintonville, and this 10,000-square-foot house might be a good example. Apologies to the owner if you're listening, but I suspect your neighbors may think it isn't the most civil piece of work relative to them.
Yeah, yeah. We're at 614-292-8513, talking obviously about architecture and architecture of our homes and buildings. Again, Jack Nasser, professor of city and regional planning at The Ohio State University, and my guest's new book, Designing for Designers, Lessons Learned from Schools of Architecture. And here is Norman. Hi, Norman. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a question, and I wanted some comments on the bridges in Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
I always kind of had the feeling that Columbus was kind of dictated to by the university and the developers. And then we had this opportunity to put a new bridge across the Scioto River downtown, which is something that everybody crosses and sees and could enjoy. And then I thought they came up with a real kind of Soviet-era bridge design. And then they go up by Ohio State on Lane Avenue, they put in a suspension bridge.
Uh-huh.
And now, right down in front of Mira Nova is going, according to the pictures I've seen, a really spectacular bridge that really nobody is going to see, I believe, except the people who live in Mira Nova and whatever the building is next to it there, which almost seems to me that this grand design has been picked to enhance the view from this wealthy development. You see what I mean here? I mean, what do you think about the Broad Street Bridge? And I'll take this off the air, all right?
Okay, Norman.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Bridges.
Go on. I think you raise a great point. There are so many aspects of our environment that we don't think about as being designed, and so that, you know, that in fact the bridge infrastructure, all the bridges that he referred to could be wonderful additions to the city, as they are in other cities. There's some of these bridges that are just wonderful to look at, whether it's through the structural design or whatnot. So that, gee, wouldn't it be great if we had some variety of, we don't want the Soviet era bridges.
What does that mean, a Soviet era?
I assume he's saying that it's just a plain, ordinary,
utilitarian.
Right, with nothing else there. I don't know the background. I haven't seen the Mira Nova bridge that he's referring to. There is a degree to which cities will invest in public infrastructure to attract private development. So Mira Nova and the building next to it, and I forget the name of it, in part were built because of Bicentennial Park, the site, so that the people who got residence in that building were able to then have an unobstructed view of a park. It might be that the part of this Mira Nova bridge is also a way to draw other development to the area. I'm not saying that might be good for the city. It brings in tax dollars. But I agree with the caller that it would be nice if we had other bridges in more publicly visible places that also inspired people. And all through the state, I was talking to someone from the Ohio Department of Transportation who was saying that there are just hundreds of bridges that she's involved with, and she really wanted to make the bridges throughout the state something that people would really enjoy, and they'd get some delight when they experienced them.
As our caller pointed out, we have this grand suspension bridge over the Olentangy River on Lane Avenue leading into the Ohio State University campus. It's very impressive. Mm-hmm. Four times the size of the width of the river. is that bridge a bit much?
Personally, I think the scale of it. I've seen bridges of that same type built elsewhere, which look much more elegant and I don't know, lighter, I guess. So I my sense is that the scale isn't quite right. But again, that's just my personal opinion.
Okay, just a personal opinion. Hello, Christina. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm originally from Rockford, Illinois. And there is a Frank Lloyd Wright building that was built for a handicapped person. Huh. And it is actually a national, I don't know what the accreditation is, but they can't change anything in it because
I'm
of it.
Sure.
Yeah. And there's also on Lake Delavan, Wisconsin, close by, mansions who do not have this accreditation, and whoever owns them can do whatever they want to them. The problem being is this handicapped house can't be changed, so nobody's buying it. And it's sat for many years unsold. I wonder what your comments about that are.
About which part of that, though?
Hey, I'm sorry. That, these grand mansions that could be owned by anyone, people can change the color, add on, do whatever they want, but, this very prairie-style plain house isn't being sold because it can't be changed at all.
What I suppose, in a sense, Jack, you do want that prairie-style Frank Lloyd Wright home not to change. How long has it been on the market, Christina?
Since I've been born, and I was born in 1984.
Oh, my goodness. You'd think somebody with a disability would love that house, and you'd think they'd find the right owner and sell it.
Well, I don't know if it's been changing hands, but it definitely has not been inhabited for as long as I've lived.
Jack, I don't know what to say about
that.
I'm
at a loss also, only to say that there is a substantial building movement throughout the U.S. and the world for this idea of universal design, which seems to be what the characteristics of this Frank Lloyd Wright house are, that are accessible. Or the degree to which we could look at, instead of looking at people as being disabled, we could look at environments as being disabling.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, given that we have a aging baby boomer generation, of which some of us are a part, at some point those millions of people are going to need houses that are much easier to get around and offer them support systems and wider doors and things like that. So maybe Sometime in the next 30 years, someone will buy that Frank Lloyd Wright house. Oh, really? Maybe it was ahead of its time. I don't know what to say. There's a degree to which, yeah, there might be a problem for cities where you have something where no one occupies it, but you do want to preserve these historic pieces of work.
Thank you, Christina. And hello, Michael. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I teach architectural photography. I've been a practicing architectural photographer since the early 1980s. And, you know, seeing the changes that have occurred in the city over the years, occasionally, not a lot, but occasionally, the Wexner Center being, I think, the first one that was just this dynamic architecture that came to the Ohio State University campus. And then the Convention Center by the same architect, even though, you know, people object to, and everybody's entitled to their opinions for certain, but I think that Columbus just needs to sit back and take a breath, because it's so exciting to actually see something so new and so fresh come in to a city like this that could otherwise just have real standard traditional-looking architecture everywhere. I mean, if you're going to object to a piece of architecture, the one Columbus building in downtown looks like it belongs on the outer belt rather than in the downtown area. We jokingly refer to it as freeway architecture because all of that looks very similar.
You're talking about what now? Most of the downtown?
Well, no, I think downtown is actually quite nice. I was saying that if you're going to object to one, the one Columbus building just doesn't seem to fit.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Which is that? I'm not sure. Which one is one Columbus?
Right at the corner of Broad and High on the west side of the street, okay. Kind of catty corner from the State House. It's a glass. It's got a glass facade. It's gray. It's very cold. It doesn't invite the pedestrian traffic at the sidewalk level at all. It's not welcoming or warming as a couple of the other really large towers down there actually scoop the pedestrian in as you walk by. It's inviting. You can stand there. You can be there. That's really nice. Now, the Convention Center doesn't seem to do that, but the fact that the surface of it undulates and that there are little small park areas that are softened with trees and plantings, it's just really pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Phil. I appreciate it. We've got to move on. Jack, go ahead.
Oh, I wish I would. I wonder for this caller whether he would have thought if the Convention Center or the Wexner Center could have been done differently so that it was still new, as he said, but also appealed to the residents. Mm-hmm. There was an implied value system in what he talked about. The Wexner and the Convention Center is new compared to the real to the standard traditional stuff, as if the standard traditional stuff was horrible. Many people will go to Paris or to other tourist destinations to walk down streets of standard traditional stuff, and they pay good money to go to Main Street in Disneyland, which is just a replication of a traditional street. So I'm not sure that we should, just because it's standard and traditional, we should throw it aside. And I'm also not sure that you just have to have standard and traditional. There's certainly ways that you could do variations on the standard and traditional that can still be exciting. I'm pretty sure that the Wexner Center and the Convention Center don't do that. They're just new.
Yeah. Okay. Caller, sorry we couldn't get to everybody today. Jack Nasser, professor of city and regional planning at The Ohio State University, my guest. His new book, Designing for Designers, Lessons Learned from Schools of Architecture. Jack, thanks very much for being with us once again.
Thank you. And I welcome listeners to check my email address if you can get it at OSU. I'd love to hear comments that you didn't get to say on the air.
What is your address?
Oh, I have time. Okay. It's nasar.1@osu.edu. And so the callers who didn't get through, please drop me a note, and I'll drop you an answer. Thank you.
nasar.1@osu.edu. Jack, thanks for being with us. News is next on listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at wosu.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.